It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's Food Friday with a focus on summer produce and how to add some twists to some of our typical summer recipes. First, the Wisconsin Supreme Court's 4-3 decision today says most absentee ballot drop boxes are not allowed in Wisconsin and that only the voter can return their ballot in person. The ruling comes before next month's primary and the fall election, where the races, especially for governor and U.S. Senate, are being watched nationally. Drop boxes had been used for some years across Wisconsin. Election clerks expanded their use for the 2020 election in response to the pandemic. Voting rights advocates say the court's decision will make it harder for people to vote, especially those with disabilities. The plaintiffs in the case say the ruling will improve voters' confidence in the election process. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this ruling? How will it affect you, if at all? Have you used a ballot drop box in past elections? Do you support or oppose them being allowed in elections? Do you want state lawmakers to come up with guidelines on how and when to use election drop boxes? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. David Cannon is a professor of political science at UW-Madison and currently editor of the Election Law Journal and affiliated with the Elections Research Center at UW-Madison. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be with you.
So what, in effect, does this mean for elections for the rest of this year?
Well, it means that it will be somewhat harder to vote for people that have gotten used to the convenience of being able to take their ballot to the drop box and put it in Dropbox. And there were 570 drop boxes used in 66 of the 72 counties around Wisconsin in our last election, the spring election, this last year. And then in 2020, we had, again, about 528 drop boxes in over 400 communities around the state. So this is a convenience people have gotten used to, and it was something that people saw as actually more secure than dropping your ballot into the mailbox, which is why people wanted to do it. Because you remember back, especially to the 2020 election, there was a lot of concern about delayed mail because of the COVID pandemic and mail getting lost and having your ballot not arrive in time to be counted. So the drop box gave you a secure way to put your ballot in the box and know that it would get to the clerk on time, because only the clerk was dealing with picking up the ballots. It didn't go into the mail stream that, again, was often delayed.
That's the Dropbox part of this ruling. Another part of it says to deliver a ballot in person, you got to bring your own ballot. You can't give it to your spouse to deliver. You can't be a neighborhood organizer or something like that. Can you talk about that particular part of the decision?
Right. Yeah. So there actually were two parts there. One had to do with mailboxes and one with drop boxes. So only for the drop box part of it did they say that you have to do this in person now. You can't have a relative, can't be anybody else. It has to be the voter to put that into the drop box. But for mailboxes, they postponed that decision because they only had three votes to say that even for mailing your absentee ballot to a mailbox, that too would have, by three of the justices wanted to also say that had to be done by the voter. But Justice Hagedorn did not sign on to that part, and so they didn't have the majority of four they needed. And so that you still can have someone else take your mailed ballot to be put in a mailbox, but you can't have someone else take it and put it in a drop box, which is kind of confusing, but that's what the decision says.
That that could change. Do you expect to see more legal challenges on that particular issue?
Yeah, there might be. But again, Hagedorn seems like he's not going to sign off on that, partly because of what you referred to in the lead into the story, which is that disability advocates are really worried about what could happen if, even for a mail ballot, you can't have someone deliver it for you to a mailbox, because there are many people in the state who, especially people who are institutionalized, wheelchair bound, bedridden, they can't get up to go put their ballot into a mailbox. And so if you would make that a requirement to vote, to say you have to personally stick it in the mailbox yourself, that could really disenfranchise thousands and thousands of voters across the state. And so I think that's why Hagedorn, wouldn't sign off on that. And it's possible we'll get more litigation on that, but that's where things stand as of today.
And that seems like it'd be tough to enforce, too. If somebody says, honey, can you bring the ballots over to the mailbox? How would you enforce something like that?
Well, right, exactly. And it, which actually raises another question about the whole premise to this ruling, which is the idea that somehow the drop boxes were less secure than mailing a ballot, because this idea that drop boxes are more prone to fraud was kind of the underlying assumption of the lawsuit. And there was no evidence presented to that effect. And if anything, I think there's stronger evidence to say that drop boxes are more secure than mailboxes. In part, as you just pointed out, you don't have like video surveillance of mailboxes. They're often just, on street corners, and you just go put whatever you want in a mailbox. Whereas the drop boxes typically were in more public places, like in front of a government building, in front of a post office or a library, and often there was video surveillance of those drop boxes. And so there, you actually could monitor, to see, what was happening at the drop boxes. And so if anything, if you're worried about election fraud, you should be encouraging more drop boxes, not taking them away.
Talking to David Cannon, political science professor at UW-Madison, looking at today's state Supreme Court decision on ballot drop boxes in Wisconsin, saying mostly we can't use them. The unattended ones that might have been in front of, say, your local library, that is out now. Also, hand delivering a ballot to a clerk's office, you have to bring your own ballot. You can't bring anybody else's. Mail, still, I guess you can still bring your spouse's to the mailbox, it sounds like, for now. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, your reactions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What do you think of today's decision? Big deal? Small deal? Does it affect the way you might vote in the future? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. David, one of the parts of this challenge, and the majority, I think, went along with this, was the idea that if we go by the letter of the law, these drop boxes aren't legit. It says to the clerk, which I guess you could interpret that as you have to hand it to the person who is the clerk, but I think that's interpreted more broadly to their office, to their appointed deputies. Clerks had said, you can deliver them to me via these drop boxes, and the court says, no, that steps beyond Wisconsin law. What do you make of that part of the argument?
Yeah, no, I think that having this as a sort of narrow textualist kind of interpretation of the law, that is a fairly reasonable interpretation. And Hagedorn's take on this, rather than the other three, I think he's the one that sort of lays out a really sort of careful legal analysis of all of the related questions. And he also deviates from the other three more conservative justices on the question of standing and whether or not there had been all the other administrative remedies had been pursued before taking it to the Supreme Court. And he disagreed with the three conservatives on both of those questions as well. And so for Hagedorn, it's a simple question that, like, the law doesn't say anything about drop boxes. It's true that the law does not prohibit drop boxes, but by interpreting the law to say that the ballots have to be returned to the municipal clerk, it can definitely be read to say that drop boxes are a convenience that could be seen as not being allowed by the law. Now, with the dissent, they actually hone in on this question of the wording of a municipal clerk versus the office of a municipal clerk. And in the statute, there are several places where the statute does refer to the office of the municipal clerk. But when it's talking about returning your ballot, it says returning the ballot to the municipal clerk, not to the office of. And so for the dissenters, they argue that this means that this should be thought of then as a municipal clerk, more broadly, and including then drop boxes. And so they actually have a part in the dissent where they say, the municipal clerk set up the drop box. They're the ones that will be, cleaning out the drop box. So that actually is returning your ballot to the municipal clerk. Now, whereas the law has said office of the municipal clerk, which it does say in several other places, then that clearly would not allow the drop boxes, because then you actually do have to take it back to the office. But the law doesn't say that. So even on narrowly interpreting the law, their difference of opinion about what those specific words mean.
We're on a caller at 800-642-1234. David is with us in Mount Horeb. David, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say that today's ruling by the Wisconsin Supreme Court lays bare to any honest observer that they are nothing more than politicians in robes. They're fulfilling Paul Ryrick's vision of reducing the electorate so that the politicians can choose their voters rather than voters choose their politicians.
David, thanks for the call. David Cannon, what do you think?
Well, I think I would agree with David on the part of the opinion that really is kind of over the top and making unsubstantiated claims about linking Dropboxes to fraud and, you know, where, again, there's no evidence for that at all, and distinguish that part of the majority opinion from, again, Hagedorn's concurring opinion. And Hagedorn was a decisive fourth vote here. And Hagedorn really sounds a lot more like the John Roberts in his hearing when he was confirmed. Remember, he says, you know, the court is about calling the balls and strikes. We don't make the law. And that's what Hagedorn is saying in his concurrence, is that, you know, we just have to interpret what the law says. To me, it seems like the law says that Dropboxes are not allowed, and we're not making policy. And Hagedorn says flat out, this is not about fraud. This is not about any of these bigger policy questions. That's up to the state legislature. What we have to decide as a court is what the law says. And to me, the law says that Dropboxes aren't allowed. So I think that you can see the political part and what David mentioned coming through in Rebecca Bradley's decision, and especially in Rogensack's concurrence, but in Hagedorn's concurrence, where, again, that's kind of that fourth vote, really is a much more restrained kind of take on this, not the over-the-top partisanship we see in the other parts of the opinion.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to David Cannon, political science professor at UW-Madison, looking at today's Wisconsin Supreme Court ruling that bars the use of most absentee ballot drop boxes in elections here in the state. You can join in with your thoughts, your reactions, your questions at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation here for some more of you coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with David Cannon, political science professor at UW-Madison, looking at the Wisconsin Supreme Court ruling today, placing restrictions on absentee voting and ballot drop boxes. You can join in with your thoughts and reactions at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls. Cheryl Ann is with us in Delavan. Cheryl Ann, hi.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, for the first time in like 40 years, I didn't get to vote in April because I was temporarily disabled from a broken hip. I didn't get to request a ballot ahead of time, blah, blah, blah. And I couldn't get to the voting station in my wheelchair to vote. And all of these barriers that they're putting up to voting is just killing our democracy. It is total anti-democracy. This fear of somebody cheating on their vote is ridiculous. It's been proven over and over again that not that many votes are invalid. And the more barriers they keep putting up is just keeping all of us from voting.
Cheryl Ann, thanks for the call. Best on your recovery from that broken hip. David, disability, temporary or permanent, a concern in this decision?
Absolutely. Especially, again, if they would extend this to not being able to have someone else drop off your ballot in a mailbox. And that would truly be a devastating impact on people who have disabilities and have mobility issues and can't get out themselves. I mean, how are they supposed to vote? Like, they really would not be able to vote. And so it's good that, again, Hagedorn, you know, voted against that. But you had three of the justices who were willing to take that step even. And so that's something that, you know, could be at stake in the future.
Sure, Land. Thanks for the call. Landon joins us next in Madison. Landon, hello.
Yes, hello. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering, dig into some of the deeper meanings of the definitions in this decision, specifically returning a ballot to the clerk or the office of the municipal clerk or defining a drop box. During the pandemic in 2020, I went through two different elections in Wisconsin, and every time I return my ballots via like a slot in the door or the office of my municipal clerk during the off hours. So, you know, there's a couple of things going on there. I wonder what this means specifically for an instance such as that, and really how far could this really go if an absentee voter isn't allowed to like return a ballot after, you know, 5 p.m. to the office of the clerk right down the street from there.
Landon, thanks for the call. David, as I understand it, a drop box would have to be attended, so a slot in the clerk's office with nobody in the clerk's office wouldn't be kosher under this ruling?
I think you're exactly right. And it again, there's some ambiguities still, even after this decision. Some of those gray areas, I think, are not well-defined. But it does seem pretty clear that I think by just a you know, common sense reading of the decision would say that an unstaffed slot in a door, so after hours, would not be permissible. Now, it's not exactly a drop box, but it is unstaffed. On the other hand, if it's literally the clerk's office, maybe that would be okay. And so that's a gray area, and Landon raises a really good question. And actually, it brings up another point we haven't talked about yet. It is another part of the state that could be affected a lot by this are the rural areas, where usually the clerks are only working, you know, a limited number of hours every week. And so the drop boxes were especially convenient for them because often the clerk's office would only be open for, say, 4 or 6 hours a week. And so you had the drop box, you know, at the clerk's office, and often and sometimes that's even the clerk's home is like what they would actually use. And so now that drop boxes aren't allowed, unmanned drop boxes, you know, that's not going to be an option in these rural areas. And so this could have, you know, broader effects on voting than we're even realizing on first glance.
Thanks for that call, Landon. Frank joins us next in Madison. Frank, hi.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for taking my call. By the way, I was a political science major at Vassar College, but I was a town clerk for 2 years, and it seems like there's a mass hysteria about the ballot boxes, as if someone could come with 100 fake ballots and stuff in there and the clerk would.
Frank is.
The ballot is vetted. Go ahead.
You're breaking up there, Frank. You were saying if somebody tried to stuff the ballot box with fake ballots, what would happen as a town clerk?
Yeah, because every ballot is vetted in advance with a, you know, driver's license online, the individual name, it's signed, their name's on it. Every ballot is reviewed when it's received. There's only one vote per person. So the only possible fraud would be if someone could get a legitimate ballot, like open it and then change the vote on it, then reseal it and put it back in the ballot box. So it's like hysteria over, I think, something that can't happen. We don't have anonymous large amounts of ballots. You
gotcha.
Know, one vote per person.
Frank, thanks for the call. David, Frank saying, yeah, you couldn't really stuff these ballot boxes.
Well, right. No, it's exactly right. And in fact, I combed through the 141 pages of the decisions today to try to find any specific claim made about fraud by the plaintiffs in the case and in the majority opinion. And the only thing they mentioned at all was that a drop box would be more of a target for someone who's trying to steal ballots because they knew that there would be ballots in the drop box, whereas in a you know, average mailbox, you don't know if there will be a ballot in there. It'll just be a bunch of other, you know, mail in there. But this, okay, so that's true as a point of logic. That's absolutely true. But as Frank points out, like, you can't do anything. Like, first of all, the ballots those drop boxes are secure. You can't, like, just break into them, at least not very easily. And even if you did, then what are you going to do? Like, how you wouldn't be able to alter those ballots in a way that wouldn't be detected. And so even that is not a legitimate claim for why these drop boxes are more likely to lead to fraud.
Thanks for the call, Frank. Tom is with us in Cable. Tom, hi.
Hi. Say, I think it's pretty clear that, you know, anybody that's got any, you know, even a minimal amount of critical thinking skills can see, you know, what's behind all of this. And you know, we beat that horse to death. But what I want to wonder if the professor could comment on is, you know, this whole thing seems to me like I can't believe it's legal, period, because if you're trying to, you know, it's clear you're trying to put barriers in front of people to everybody has a right to vote. So if you're putting barriers out there for people to vote, that does not seem legal to me at all. And I'm just wondering if there's just a broader legal question that could be discussed about that. I mean, you know, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, all that sort of stuff.
Tom,
I mean, how does that figure into this?
Thanks for the call. David, could this be considered disenfranchising people? I'm guessing it'd be a tough case to make in a court saying, hey, everybody still has the access to the mail and in-person voting. Possibly, though, with voters with disabilities, if they lost that ability for that ballot handoff, if they couldn't physically deliver it.
Right. There, I think that you'd have to have that additional step taken, you know, to actually make it almost impossible for someone with a disability to vote. Then I think Tom's point is right on. That absolutely would be disenfranchisement for sure. But when you're just talking about absentee voting generally, then the guiding statute is what's in question, and we have these different opinions then about exactly whether or not that statute does permit drop boxes or not, and the majority said today that it does not. And so that is a much narrower question having to do with statutory interpretation of that specific law rather than a broader question about the right to vote. But I agree with you, Rob, entirely that broader question would be put on the table if they did actually take away the right of someone else to put a disabled person's ballot into a mailbox.
Thanks for that call. And David, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Well, it's good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
That's David Cannon, professor of political science at UW-Madison, currently editor of the Election Law Journal, affiliated with the Elections Research Center at UW-Madison. David joined us today to cover today's state Supreme Court ruling disallowing most absentee ballot drop boxes. Coming up after the news, it's this week's edition of Food Friday, with a focus on summer produce and how to start cooking with an abundance of fruits and veggies. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, there's a wide world of movies out there. A Wisconsin film expert joins the show to share some great foreign language films and how to get started. Now, fresh summer produce is filling grocery store shelves and farmers market booths as we head into the middle of summer. But what do we do with all those veggies? It's Food Friday, and our guest has lots of advice on making the most of the season. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What summer produce do you always have the most of? What do you look forward to? What fruits or veggies do you enjoy cooking with in the summertime? Do you have a favorite recipe? What do you do with all the zucchini that's on the way? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Aaron Clark is a Wisconsin-based cook and founder of Well Plated by Aaron, a blog with healthy and affordable recipes. She's the cookbook author of The Well Plated Cookbook, fast, healthy recipes you'll want to eat. Aaron, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
All right. What kind of produce, Aaron, do you have filling up your kitchen right about now?
I mean, should we just talk about the Z word? Like, I think we should just get right after it. Funnily enough, we don't have, I have a really small yard and we don't have room to grow vegetables. So I have a proliferation of herbs, which I love. But I always say I don't need to grow my own zucchini,
right?
Because I have people in my life who grow zucchini. And like, I feel like I'm just going to open my back door one day and there's just going to be a huge bag of it. And I'm just going to have to come up with something to do with it. But it's kind of a fun problem to have too. I love zucchini, both for sweet and savory recipes. So it is a quote unquote problem that I look forward to every summer.
And I've got some zucchini in my garden. I'm not a great gardener, so it's going to be a little while yet before I have the produce. Grilling. You're a big fan of grilling zucchini and of eggplant, which I also planted this year, and I've already eaten, you know, one little guy. Talk about grilling those zucchinis and eggplants.
That is just our go-to simple summer side. I think people, when we think about grilling, we tend to immediately turn to meat, but vegetables are phenomenal on the grill. Even people who, even if you think that you don't really care for eggplant, if you slice it thinly and throw it on the grill with some olive oil and seasonings, it comes out so tender. You get that nice char flavor. Cauliflower is also phenomenal on the grill. This is going to sound like a weird word to use, but it almost tastes meaty. And another trick you can use to give your grilled vegetables even more flavor, my favorite way to season them is with steak seasoning, believe it or not. So a rub that you would normally use for a steak, try it on some cauliflower, try it on your zucchini or eggplant. It gives it a really rich peppery flavor that combined with that signature char from the grill is so delicious. You know, big plate of that. You know, maybe just like a caprese salad and some shrimp or whatever on the side if you want. Like, you can have a summer dinner with almost no cooking at all.
Yeah, you know, actually for years in my house, the go-to zucchini seasoning was a certain chef's BAM hamburger seasoning. What is it about that? Why does that work so well with zucchini? The stuff you'd put on beef, it tastes great on zucchini.
Yeah, you know, something that I love about zucchini, other than the fact, I mean, it's healthy, it's super fast, but it's, if you think about it, it's pretty mild. So I feel like whatever kind of seasonings you want to throw at it, it is an excellent vehicle for that, because the zucchini is not going to take over. It's just going to let that yummy seasoning shine. Or, you know, maybe our brains are just wired to love hamburger seasoning. That's whatever the reason, I'm here for it.
We're talking to Aaron Clark on this edition of Food Friday. Aaron's the author of the Well-Plated Cookbook, Fast Healthy Recipes You'll Want to Eat. We are talking about summer produce, what's with us now, what is coming in the weeks and months ahead. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What are you excited about in your garden, your farmer's market, showing up fresh at the grocery store? What are you cooking with it? Do you have questions for Aaron about what to do with product X? And what is your solution for zucchini overload? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Aaron, you mentioned you've got a lot of herbs going. We've got some on our porch, too. Basil, and you've got a recipe. We've got this at WPR.org/Food Friday for your basil pesto. Talk to us about the basics of pesto making.
Definitely. So I think when most of us picture pesto, we think of that classic Italian basil pesto, which is phenomenal as everything from a sandwich spread, pasta sauce. You can marinate with it. And it's a great way to use up a lot of that fresh basil and just take advantage of that abundance. But basil is certainly not the only option. The basics of any pesto are going to be some kind of green, whether it is herbs, or I actually like to put spinach in mine too to sneak in a little veggie, nuts. So pine nuts are classic. They're also really expensive, but you don't have to use pine nuts. You could use walnuts, cashews. You can use sunflower seeds if you have a nut allergy, and then olive oil and Parmesan. So you really can play around with that to create some unusual combinations with what you have. So for example, if your parsley is doing great, try a pesto with parsley and almonds. I really like kale and mint and pistachio together. You really can have a lot of fun with it. And I honestly just can't think of a way that you can go wrong.
Yeah, I got to say, Aaron, there's a turning point in my life, because it used to be like, okay, I'm making pesto, I must precisely, they say basil, I use basil. They say pine nuts, I use pine nuts, and so on. When I realized that you could do the stuff that you were just talking about, like I could do cilantro and almonds, and I don't know if it's pesto anymore, but it's awesome. Like, we could really experiment with this stuff.
It's true. And it's one of those things in the kitchen where it's so fun to be creative. Pesto, you know, whatever you want to call it, it just brightens up dishes. It makes them taste so just alive and like summer. And it's one of those moments for me where I feel like, yes, like I mean, isn't it just such a good feeling to be like, I made something awesome.
Yeah.
And then if you grilled it yourself or it's local, that is just like even more pride that you can put into cooking. It's just really beautiful and really fun.
And, you know, one thing is, if you have too much of something, like your basil's gone nuts this year or something, you can make the pesto and then you can freeze it, right? Could you talk about a little bit about the freezing of the produce that's out there now?
Definitely. So there is just nothing better on a Wisconsin winter day than busting out a container of the pesto and just bringing a taste of that vibrancy back to kind of beat those winter blues a little bit. The biggest tip that I have for freezing pesto and storing pesto in general is air is its enemy. The second the air starts to touch the surface of the pesto, it really steals its flavor. So what I'll usually do is portion it into small containers. I even have some friends that like to use ice cube trays for their herbs, and then they'll just, you know, pop them in a pot of soup. For us, I usually do a little bit bigger, kind of what I would need to do a pot of pasta. And then I really press the plastic wrap against the top to get rid of all that air. If you don't want to use plastic, another great option is that you can just drizzle some olive oil on top, and that provides a nice seal for it too.
Now, my wife just did this with some basil stuff, and I think the warning here is that ice cube tray is now dedicated to herbal products. Don't think you're going to go back to using it for ice anymore.
Oh, yeah, unless you want like a little garlic kick to your water there.
And I don't. I really don't.
No.
All right, again, find that basic pesto recipe with variations at WPR.org/Food Friday. Oh, yeah, right. Before we move on from that, you've got a tip. If people are like, yeah, I want the pesto, but I'm vegan or I don't want dairy for whatever reason, what are options if we don't want the Parmesan in it?
Definitely. So, I mean, your first option is you can just leave it out. Parmesan adds a nice kind of salty and umami type of flavor. So you're going to want to season it with a little bit of additional salt to taste to make up for that. Another, I would recommend toasting your nuts for pesto. I like to do that anyway. You can kind of get away with skipping it if you're using Parmesan, but if you're omitting that Parmesan, toast the nuts first just to kind of build some of that flavor back in. And then another fantastic alternative is a product called nutritional yeast, which when I first saw it, I thought seemed like really weird and hippy dippy, but it's not. It's available at the grocery store. Like, you know, you can pick it up at Pick and Save, and it has some health benefits, but I really love it because it has that same umami and almost cheesy flavor that Parmesan cheese does. So you can swap that. I would use a little bit less nutritional yeast. So if a recipe calls for 1/4 cup of Parmesan, which is 4 tablespoons, I would maybe dial it down to 3 tablespoons on the nutritional yeast.
We got an email from Grant. Grant says they discovered a fantastic Mexican herb called papicha, P-I-P-I-C-H-A. Has an aroma and flavor, Grant says, that resembles cilantro or lemon basil. Great mixed into a focaccia dough or in addition to any dried bean dish. I feel like I've heard this name and I know absolutely nothing about it. So I'll call myself 90% stumped, Erin. How about you?
That is really unusual. I really enjoy shopping at the farmer's market. I haven't seen that around, but I would love to know if I can find it or grow it myself. I'm just reading a little bit about it now. I love the focaccia idea. It looks like it's great on fish and in some different soups too.
Oh yeah. I came across it. Somebody was talking about Oaxacan recipes on the show. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm looking online. Mm-hmm. You and I are both searching online for papicha.
And I'm like,
all right, well, we both have to try it now. Well, it's Food Friday. We're talking to Erin Clark, founder of Well Plated, author of the book, The Well Plated Cookbook, Fast Healthy Recipes You'll Want to Eat. You can join the food conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you a gardener? What types of produce do you always end up having too much of? What's hopping out at you right now? What are you going to do with it this weekend? Do you have zucchini contingency plans in case you end up with a couple baseball bat-sized zucchini after going away for a week or something like that? I don't know. Call it at 800-642-1234. Share your favorite summer seasonal produce. That's 800-642-1234. Find some great recipes from Erin at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday talk with Erin Clark, Wisconsin cook, author of the Well-Plated Cookbook, Fast Healthy Recipes You'll Want to Eat. We are cooking with summer produce, figuring out what to do with it, even if we have too much of something. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your advice, your favorites, what's in your garden, what's in your farmer's market right now that you're excited about. What questions do you have? 800-642-1234. Is the number to call. Let's go to your calls now. Mark is with us in Two Rivers. Mark, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. I just wanted to share with you some of the things that my wife and I do with pesto. We find a store-bought pesto that we really enjoy, and we will mix it with ricotta cheese. When we're making lasagna, we'll put it in soup stock. We'll put it in our pasta sauces. It's a real good all-around spice. We're picking things up. But one of our favorite things to do is we'll find a nice store-bought pizza crust. And instead of putting down a tomato paste-style sauce, we'll put down a layer of pesto, and then on top of that, we'll put grilled onions and blue cheese and then pop that in the oven. And it sounds kind of unusual, but it is extremely good.
Mark, I love it. Thanks so much for sharing that. Yeah, Aaron, one of our go-tos is a quick flatbread pizza with pesto, whether, like Mark, sometimes I get store-bought stuff, but if I've got good fresh stuff, there's no better flatbread pizza.
It is so delicious. We love pesto. I especially love that with some roasted tomatoes and goat cheese. My husband's more of a red sauce pizza person, so sometimes we'll actually mix red sauce and pizza sauce together, pesto and the classic red tomato sauce together, and it really is kind of that's a really fun one to try too.
Mark, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Heather joins us now in La Crosse. Heather, hi. Are you there, Heather? I don't think, it looks like she had a zucchini recipe for us. Heather, try calling back. We're not hearing you if you're talking at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Well, instead of a zucchini recipe, Aaron, you shared with us a grilled corn salad. Can you tell us about this recipe?
Mm-hmm. There's another piece of produce I eagerly wait for at the farmer's market. And I think there's a bit of fervor, like whenever the first sweet corn of the season comes to the farmer's market, there's really nothing like it. While grilled corn on the cob is delicious and classic, if you're going to a party or you want something that's just a little easier to eat, but that is still really just scrumptious and fresh and seasonal, I love to make a grilled corn salad. So you grill the corn, cut the ears off of it, or cut the kernels off of the grilled cob. And then I just mix it with some really simple like avocado, feta cheese, or you could use a queso fresco, and then a bright lime dressing. It kind of reminds me of Mexican street corn a little bit. It is to die for.
Now, if I want to make a salad like this with corn, I'm not necessarily going to fire up my charcoal grill to grill precisely one ear of corn. What are your thoughts on getting kind of a good roasted or grill-like flavor inside?
You can totally do that. So first of all, just go ahead and grill like several ears of corn. No one will be mad if there's extra. And you can add extra. That salad calls for a couple of ears. But I've actually had good luck if you cut the kernels off of the cob before they're cooked, and then spread them on a sheet pan with some olive oil, salt, and pepper, and you can actually get a really nice char effect using your oven's broiler. So I will just pop that under the broiler. Don't walk away. That's the classic broiler like switch that I feel like that always happens to me. The second I walk away, my broiler burns whatever is underneath it. But you can get kind of a really nice crisp color on there too. You don't get the same charred flavor, but it really gives you that nice texture.
It sounds fantastic. Again, find that recipe at WPR.org/Food Friday. You can join our Food Friday conversation at 800-642-1234. Aaron Clark with us, author of the Well-Plated Cookbook. You can find a Well-Plated by Aaron online. You can also find a few recipes from Aaron at WPR.org/Food Friday. We're talking about what to do with our summer produce. You can tell us what you are looking forward to making this weekend at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Aaron, your advice to not walk away from the broiler reminds me of one of my favorites with kale. I like to make kale chips in the oven.
Oh, so good.
And that's one where if you walk away for 2 minutes, you're going to burn your kale chips. Kale starts in the spring, comes back in the fall. What are some of your favorite kale-y things to do?
Well, I mean, kale pesto is actually very good.
Oh, yeah.
Try blending in some white beans with it. It makes like a really hearty, healthy sauce. We love kale chips over here too. And I'm actually a huge fan. I know they've gotten a bad rap, but I love kale salads. In my cookbook, I have kind of a build your own. I call it the three killer kale salads that will take you through the seasons. The biggest difference is if you chop your kale into really super fine ribbons, and then you've got to massage it. So I just sprinkle it with a pinch of salt, and then you just get in there with clean hands and grab handfuls of it for several minutes. And what you'll notice happens is the kale turns dark green and becomes more fragrant. Massaging it breaks down the fibers, and it gives it almost this buttery texture. And in addition to being super, super good for you, because kale is a heartier green, that salad can last in the refrigerator for 3 or 4 days. So on the weekend, I love to massage a whole bunch of kale, like toss together a salad with a little bit of salad dressing, And then I kind of just pull from it all week, liven it up with a little more dressing. And it just makes getting a healthy meal on the table so much quicker and easier.
Now, for me, I like kale in any form pretty much. But to me, fresh kale versus something I get at a grocery store out of season, that's one of the biggest differences. Like that fresh stuff, like it's way more tender. It's less bitter. I don't know. That's one to really enjoy fresh, I feel like.
Totally. The stuff from the grocery store we'll use for smoothies sometimes. If you add pineapple or mango to a kale smoothie, and then along with a tablespoon or two of peanut butter, I don't know, there's something magical that the pineapple, especially in peanut butter, due to kale, that just makes the kale sort of fade into the distance. Like, it just really, even my husband, who, like, the first time I made a kale smoothie, he was like, get that away from me. now he makes them willingly, which I'm pretty sure is the biggest endorsement that I can offer.
You got your peanut butter in my kale. Yeah, I wouldn't have thought of that one, I guess.
I know it sounds, I'm going to be honest, it sounds weird. Like, I get it. You're listening to this and like, why would I put that together? Just give it a try. Just open mind.
I might give that a try. Now, preserving. Now, you and I think, are on kind of the same page. I used to like actually can. I had a canner. I would can things. Now, I don't. But I'll like fridge pickle to do stuff. And you do that too, I understand. What are a couple of your favorite things to do, just a quick, you know, toss it in vinegar or whatever and have in the fridge?
I would say having pickled red onions on hand will just make everything in your life better. I love to add them to salads. They're great added to grilled cheese, tacos. I mean, sometimes I will honestly just like snack on them a little bit out of the fridge kind of while I'm cooking. But that truly, when you're talking about maximum reward for minimal effort, it's hard to beat pickled onions. And I do have a recipe for pickled onions on my website, wellplated.com, for free. All my recipes are free. But if people are specifically looking for the one I make, that's the one I make.
Yeah, I love red onions is the go-to thing for me, to just like toss those quick and use them in a meal later in the day or later in the week.
I want to try radishes. Like, I feel like radishes and jalapenos could both be really good too. So those are on my list for taco night next.
I'll say I do radishes. My one warning is there's something magical about the smell of even a quick pickled radish. It's terrible. But it tastes really good. So just prepare to have your fridge dominated. Maybe give it an extra couple layers or something with the quick pickled radish. That is my warning.
Really?
Too. Yeah.
Okay. I appreciate,
it's chemistry,
I appreciate
or something.
That.
Now, okay. We've mostly been focusing on summertime vegetable stuff. And fall, though, is my favorite season. Give us a sneak preview. What are you excited about as, you know, September rolls around?
I just love butternut squash so much. I know most people are really excited for pumpkin. And, you know, pumpkin certainly has its place, but the yellow squash that forever has my heart is butternut squash. I just like roast it in casseroles and soups. I can't get enough. And then here in Wisconsin especially, I'm so excited about apples. I love to go apple picking. Always way over pick on apples, so that turns into the same problem as my zucchini. Fortunately, apples last a long time, but I'm looking forward to using apples in all kinds of sweet and savory recipes this fall too.
And that reminds me, I skipped another recipe. You gave us a peach crisp. I'm a huge crisp fan because it's easy. You don't have to make a pie crust like this. Peaches in our crisp. Tell us about it.
That is a summer. I just think it's so cruel how short stone fruit season is, especially peaches. When you need a dessert that people are just going to go crazy over, I mean, you really just can't. A peach crisp. Summer peach crisp with vanilla ice cream. It really just does not get any better than that. It's almost dangerous because it's so quick and easy to stir together. And, you know, once peaches sadly fade into the background, you know, you can use that same recipe with apples. Mm-hmm. I've actually done a mix of apples and pears together. That's really nice. You can do, if you don't have enough peaches, I just did a peach and blueberry crisp last week that was absolutely fantastic. There's lots of room for playing around, and it's a peach crisp is a very user-friendly dessert. So I always say that is a great one for anyone to make. And yeah, people just go crazy over it.
Erin, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks for having me. It's been great.
That's Wisconsin's own Erin Clark, founder of Well Plated by Erin, author of the Well Plated Cookbook. She joined us on Food Friday to talk about cooking with great summer produce. Find some of those recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. By the way, got a follow-up from Grant, who talked about that Mexican herb called pepicha. He says he found it at the Hilldale Farmers Market in Madison. So it is findable here in the state. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, summertime is a time to take care of our skin, get advice on using sunscreen, and find out why some of the world's best sun protection may not be available here in the United States. Huh. That's today on Central Time from 3... Oh, sorry, that's Monday on The Morning Show. Archaeological discoveries can paint us an amazing picture of human life in a different era. The remains of Pompeii frozen in time by a disastrous volcano. Egyptian tombs unsealed after thousands of years. And now, a Burger King at a shopping mall sealed up for more than a decade. The historic-ish find comes from a shopping mall in Wilmington, Delaware. It started a couple months back when a contractor working at the mall shared a picture online. There's a gap in one of those fake walls that malls use to block off closed stores. The picture showed a 1980s-era Burger King restaurant fully intact. Since then, local media outlets followed up the story. The Burger King in question opened in 1987, closed in 2009 with that original 1980s decor in place. Usually malls use those fake walls to hide the empty space till something moves in, but nothing did. So there it sat undisturbed for 13 years. Who knows what secrets the lost Burger King of Wilmington might reveal? As a great archaeologist once said, that belongs in a museum. This is Central Time.